My name is Mark Kane, and I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellants. My Supreme Court number is 11355. Three evidentiary issues occurred in the trial in this case. I think that I'm going to bundle them in just that many issues. The first is the medical bills, and I believe that those were endorsed inappropriately under Rule 26, and they were late under Rule 37, and they should not be admitted. The second is the expert testimony of the CPA and the accident investigator, Officer Ortiz. And the third is the excessive verdict / jury coercion issues. First, the medical bills. They were indeed properly endorsed under Rule 26, 15 days before trial. And I don't think that's a question here. I think under Rule 26, they're supposed to be endorsed 30 days before or more. They were not. And then under Rule 37, the failure to disclose those bills makes them inadmissible. And I think that 37 is a self-executing rule. And it should be interpreted, the burden to show that there is harmless error should have been imposed against the non-conforming party. And that's that Todd versus Bear case that I've cited.
Counsel, are we talking about 100% of the medical bills that relate to the $60,000 in damages, or just some of them?
No, I think not produced. It was virtually 100%.
All right, so you knew that $60,000 or so was a claim for damages, but you also knew that no medical bills had been produced more than 30 days before trial.
It changed. It started out as about 20. In the initial disclosures, the suggestion was there's about 20,000. I asked for them at that time, and they said they'd be provided in due course.
Medical bills?
The medical bills.
Okay, go ahead.
They then went up to 60. And indeed, Mr. Tucker did something and he's a very good lawyer, by the way, Mr. Tucker, did something that I've never seen happen, and he provided me with a copy of his settlement statement that we used before Tom Nelson, the mediator. And in there, he suggests that there's $60,000 in medical bills, but I had still not seen the bills.
When was that?
Goodness.
November 24th.
Thank you.
Well before trial, 60 days before trial.
Well, I was told there were $60,000 in bills. I still hadn't seen them.
And you would request those by a document request?
Yes.
And you moved to compel them?
Yes. Well, actually, I moved to, my motion was in limine to strike them because they had not been provided timely.
You didn't move to compel a production of those bills, though.
I'm sorry, sir.
You didn't file a motion under Rule 26 to compel production of these bills that you would ask for but did not receive.
And that's correct. I did not.
Okay.
I did not. It was as we were preparing for trial, I noted that I did not have the bills, and I had a motion hearing about 10 days prior to trial where I asked the court to strike the bills because they had not been
I understand that. Reversed. I just was wondering what happened before the motion limine was filed to try to get the bills, and there was no effort to compel the production of those
there
bills.
There was no effort to compel, and that's right. Okay. I did not do that. I agree.
Can I ask you, Mr. Kane? Sure. I mean, the district court obviously agreed with you that they were late, and then the court said, but it was inadvertent, and I don't find prejudice. And I'll just be very candid with you. The issue on this one for me is prejudice, because there's no question they were late. I mean, they were late. And so I'm not sure that I really heard or read in your brief, or maybe I'm just not, I'm maybe missing it, what the prejudice argument is here. Yes, the argument made was, you know, you needed time to look at these, you wanted to review them with your client, you wanted to deal with settlement. So I recognize we shouldn't easily say no prejudice, and courts are real good about that. But it's hard to see what in the record shows how you were prejudiced, that you were unable to prepare for trial because you got them late or anything like that.
Well, I wasn't able to have them reviewed by medical care providers, but indeed, I didn't really focus on that portion of this case. To me, it was a liability case, and I'll confess that to you. But it also, I think that the rules are the rules. And if they're not endorsed in a properly and they're not given to me in a timely manner, I get to object. And I think the Todd case says it's not my job to show the burden, to satisfy the burden.
There's no question that that's right. And it's the Ms. Ireland's job was to show prejudice here or lack of prejudice here. And the court found it, though. That's what I'm trying to get at. And in my practice, I was with you. The rules are the rules. But the court, part of the rules are the court has some discretion and you're trying to get to fairness and rulings on the merits. And so without a showing of prejudice, it seems to me the court had a lot of leeway to say, I don't find any prejudice, I'm going to let him in.
Well, and indeed, I wasn't quick enough, smart enough to note for the court that if he allows these medical bills to be laid endorsed, he's going to be able to blackboard that same amount in his closing argument. And he did. And I think that there's the prejudice there as well. And again, all of a sudden, I was on the spot. The defense was on the spot to respond to this issue when it wasn't my duty to respond. It should have been Ms. Ireland's duty.
But the point that I guess I'm trying to drill down on here is, okay, they put the numbers on the board, and you would absolutely have prejudice. If you got surprised, if there was a number that you disagree with that you couldn't cross-examine on because you didn't have enough time, any of that, it seems to me that you, at least in response to an argument, no prejudice, have some duty to say why you are prejudiced to respond. And that's what I'm still not hearing.
Okay, well, and I did. I responded to at the trial level that I'd like a chance to go over these. I'd like to talk about it with my client. I'd like to be able to incorporate this stuff now into my case in a timely manner. All of a sudden, my preparation changed entirely from one to another because now I know these bills are endorsed and they're coming in, and I have to deal with them in some manner. And all that changed for me. And that's why I wanted additional time. And the court said, are you asking for a continuance? And I said, yes, I am. And I think under the JP court, that was the appropriate remedy, is to continue the damn thing. Pardon me. I apologize.
Were the bills introduced by the plaintiff?
Yes.
She testified to what her medical expenses were?
Yes.
How did not having the bills hamper your cross-examination of her as to the amounts?
Not so much her, but also her care providers. That I wanted to attack on the reasonableness and necessity of the bills and that kind of thing. And I needed to have somebody else look at the bills that could tell me if this surgical bill was reasonable and necessary, if this rehab bill is reasonable and necessary.
Did you know those amounts, were they broken down? Was $60,000 broken down to the surgical amount, the rehab amount beforehand based on that settlement statement?
I think not in the settlement statement, but I do believe that there was a summary provided to me.
Right.
Also, and to be fair, there was a summary provided to me as well. But again, I want to see the bills, and I think I'm entitled to see the bills. And I don't. Would I'm trying to accuse Mr. Tucker of lying to me.
I'm trying to figure out what your prejudice might be. Were you unable to go to experts to ask them to opine upon the reasonableness of those broken down fees because you didn't have the bills?
Well, I didn't know the actual amounts. I didn't have the bills. And I don't think it would have been appropriate for me to cross-examine somebody on a summary that was provided to me by plaintiff's counsel, that if I'm going to have somebody review the bills, I got to have the bills to have them reviewed. I can't have the summary reviewed. The detail.
Experts to do that?
No. I had 2 weeks. And as I told the court, in my mind, this was first a liability case and second a damages case. And I won't, you know, make any sugar coatings on that. Moving on. Yeah, really moving on. I think that Urbeth should have been allowed to testify as the ultimate issue. He was endorsed by both myself and Mr. Tucker as an expert in this case. Tucker deposed him. We had a CV. He had an opinion as to fault and was not allowed to give that opinion. I think that's and the basis for the court's denial of to me of that right to pull that evidence from his was that it was the ultimate issue, and that was for the jury to decide. And I think that Rule 702 says, no, that's not an appropriate basis.
Is that correct, Mr. Kahneman? I guess I had in my head that the court ruled based on 403, or maybe it's just the issue you're now raising is 403. Did the court specifically talk about ultimate issue as well?
I don't think the court used those words.
Okay.
So if
I can assume with me for a minute that my memory is right, and it could certainly be wrong, that this is a 403 issue, I guess for me, again, I'm going to go right to the prejudice issue, or really it's an abuse of discretion here. Assuming the court ruled on 403, how is it an abuse of discretion? You both had other accident reconstructionists here. The court was concerned, and here's an officer who's going to show up in uniform. This officer never talked to Ms. Ireland, just talked to your client, or the truck driver.
That's right.
And the court had, so the court said, at least thinking, I'm concerned whether we're going to get a correct picture here. And court said excluded under 403. So how is that an abuse of discretion given all those facts?
Well, given those facts, that would be just cannon fodder, or just fodder for cross-examination. That Mr. Tucker could have said, well, you never talked to my client, did you? And Mr. Tucker could have asked, all those things. And he could have prepared the jury for that same issue during voir dire. All of those things could have been handled differently. And I think that he was endorsed as an expert. We treated him as an expert right up to the last moment. He had an opinion as an expert. He was an appropriate expert. He should have been allowed to testify. The CPA, on the other hand, I think went too far. I think that the CPA used specialized knowledge in generating her opinion in this case, which was a loss of income or a wage loss of about $75,000. She had specialized knowledge, and she used it. She was a very pleasant woman. There's no doubt about that.
It has to be specialized knowledge based on, I think, education, training, and something else, not specialized knowledge because she happened to work as a CPA for this plaintiff's practice.
I'm not sure that's correct, sir. I think that it says that the rule talks about either relies on education, specialized, but the specialized knowledge, even in this case, would be based on education and experience.
So you're saying in any case, a timekeeper for a company can't testify as to how many hours a person lost?
Not at all. Not at all. No.
Isn't this woman basically like a timekeeper?
Not at all.
Tell me what she did beyond what she called mathematical calculation. I didn't exactly pick that up from your brief. Tell us what she did.
Beyond what she did was she drew on her experience as a bookkeeper. She drew on her experience when dealing with insurance companies. Did some mathematical averaging because of those concerns. Talked about the special sort of billing practices, or how do I define this? I'll call them billing practices of anesthesiologists. It's not per procedure, it's per unit.
Of anesthesiologists or this practice specifically?
Of anesthesiologists. Generally. The way that she spoke about it.
Okay.
But indeed, let's be fair, we were talking about this particular practice.
So, testimony about anesthesiologists in general, how did that fit into this case?
Well, it explained her testimony as to this lost wage claim, because anesthesiologists are paid per unit.
Lost wage claim went to the billable practices.
Yeah, the lost earnings would be a better way to put it. I apologize. But yeah, like that. And that's how it came up in this case. But if you read her opinions in the record, it's clear. It's specialized knowledge based on education and experience. And that's something that she shouldn't be allowed to testify or offer opinions based upon. And that's 70121.
Two, but that's okay. That's one number between friends.
Then finally,
Mr. Kane, I know you have limited time, but just to follow up on this last piece quickly, I guess I'm not sure, I'm not still not clear on what. Where this CPA testified that went beyond what this anesthesiologist did. I mean, Ms. Ireland was an anesthesiologist. This is the bookkeeper for 10 years,
right,
who said, you know, even if she used the phrase anesthesiologist generally, wasn't it clear from the record she's talking about this person's records and how this person kept records?
I think it's at least fair to say that she was talking about this group of anesthesiologists. Okay, but again,
this group meaning this practice,
right? Is that what you're saying?
This practice, and it's when I call the group, it's those other people that she shares overhead and income with, and I think that that's fair.
Okay.
I think that that's what happened in this case, but I still think that she applied some accounting techniques, some other specialized applications to the rules that she shouldn't have been able to do without at least providing me with a report as to explaining why or how, and that wasn't done. Finally, I got about a minute. I think the verdict was excessive. This is an incredibly unique plaintiff. She races bicycles, and she's an anesthesiologist, and she's very good at both. And she was racing and winning before the accident, and a mere 5 months after the accident, she's racing and winning again. But even then, the jury awarded her $275,000 for non-economic losses. And I suggest to you, given the totality of the circumstance, that's too much, especially since they didn't have any idea what to do with liability at 5 minutes to five. And then, this is the jury coercion issue. And then at 5:30, not only have they resolved the liability issue, but they've awarded this, what I believe to be an excessive verdict. So I'm gonna save my last 24 seconds for whatever I can. Thanks so much.
Good morning. My name is Wendell Wahlberg, and I'm attorney registration number 13056. and I represent Christine Ireland. I'd like to sort of start at the beginning, I guess. I think the significant problem that that the defendant has here is that all of the rulings that were made here, with possible exception of the jury deliberation question, are rulings which were within the absolute discretion of the trial court, so long as he was able to articulate a reasonable basis for making those decisions. And in this case, there was clearly articulated on the record a reasonable basis for the making of each of these decisions. With respect to the medical summary and the medical bills, as has been discussed here, the trial court asked the defense what prejudice it had suffered, and was advised that, well, if they had had them a little earlier, they might have looked at them a little more carefully and incorporated that information into their settlement evaluation and perhaps made a further settlement offer. In fact, the record reflects that a further settlement offer was made on the morning of trial, and that that further settlement offer was declined. And so, to the extent that the trial court was advised on any level as to what prejudice the defendant felt it had suffered by the late production of these actual documents, that prejudice was able to be cured or was able to be addressed as far as anyone was advised. The defense makes quite a point of saying it was Ms. Ireland's burden to show that there was no prejudice. I think the court recognizes that proving a negative is somewhere between difficult and impossible, and the way that the court attempted to address that in this case was to ask what prejudice had been suffered, and if there had been something articulated which the court could address by continuance, or which defense counsel felt it could do if there was a continuance, then perhaps the decision would have been different. But if the defense can't articulate prejudice other than we wanted to discuss these numbers with our client, and they have the opportunity still to do that, and in fact apparently did and made a further decision, the prejudice becomes difficult to identify, or perhaps impossible.
Is it prejudicial not to be able to challenge numbers by hiring experts to review the reasonableness of the bills? Would that have been a prejudice?
It might have been a prejudice, although in this case...
That wasn't. Was that articulated to the trial court?
No, it was not articulated.
The first time I heard it was today.
Yes. And again, here, I think one of the points to be noted is that the standard is not prejudice. All evidence, presumably, if I want to put it on behalf of my client, would be prejudicial. But what we're talking about here, this is the sum total of the medical bills that are in question. There in the record, there's about 25 or 30 pages. We're talking about an anesthesiology bill. We're talking about a hospital bill for a surgery. We're talking about a surgeon's bill. We're talking about $12,000 worth of physical therapy. This woman was thrown off of a bike on the side of a road, hit by a semi-truck, suffered several fractures, had a surgery, and went through 5 months of physical therapy following the surgery to attempt to recover from this injury. $60,000 is not a lot of money. I think the court's probably seen enough of that to know. I think probably the defense knew that it wasn't an unreasonable number when it saw it in the settlement statement in November and in the trial management order in December, and that's why they didn't ask for them.
Were the numbers ever actually disputed at trial, the $60,000?
To the best of my knowledge, they were not, Your Honor.
Well, I guess let me ask a more specific question. Was the work challenged as unreasonable?
I do not believe so. I don't believe there was anyone who suggested that Ms. Ireland obtained medical treatment that was not necessary or reasonable in the circumstances.
Thank you.
With Ms. Hedemark, I have to agree with the comments of the court. She did have specialized knowledge. So does every witness. Nobody testifies in court to information that doesn't pertain to the case. They testify, I was there, I saw, I witnessed, I was, I did. I was there. I know something about this. I have specialized knowledge concerning this circumstance. That's why we put him on the stand. If the doctor didn't treat the patient, he has no knowledge about the patient. He can't testify. If the witness didn't see the accident, or they don't know the plaintiff, or they don't know the defendant, or they don't know anything about what's going on, why would we put them on the stand? Of course she had specialized knowledge. But I think your point is proper, that the question is whether she stated an opinion based on specialized knowledge. She didn't. She testified to her specialized knowledge of the facts of this case. And specialized knowledge or particular knowledge of facts, so long as there is a reasonable basis upon which the witness knows those facts, are always admissible, unless they're excluded under 403 because they're too prejudicial or they're unfairly prejudicial. But Ms. Hedemark testified to facts. She said, They're paid based on units of time. They're paid based on on-call work. They're paid if they're in a pain pool. This is how this practice runs its payment.
And she has personal knowledge of all of that because she's the one who kind of keeps those books.
She does the math herself, and she collects the information from the insurance companies. She determines what the average cost or price per unit that the companies pay is. She divides that among the practice in her work as their bookkeeper. She does this work. She determines what the dollar value per unit is, and then she applies that to the units that are worked. Frankly, Ms. Hedemark could have testified to all of that and said, for every day they work, they get 16 units, and they're paid this many dollars per unit. And if they didn't work 16 units, then they weren't working a full day. And for every on-call day that they're available, they get paid this many dollars. And Christine Ireland could have gotten on the stand and said, I missed 10 days full-time, I missed 4 on-call days, and I had 50 days only worked part-time. And Mr. Tucker could have gotten up in closing argument and blackboarded the same numbers. Ms. Hedemark said this, Ms. Ireland said this. He could have done the math on the blackboard. In the courtroom, it just happened that it was a little more expeditious to let Ms. Hedemark do it or testify to it because she'd already done it ahead of time. And all of those facts, if Mr. Kane wanted to cross-examine on those, certainly he could have cross-examined Ms. Hedemark on, well, you know, how do you get those averages? Do you really do that work? Are they really paid this much? Does it happen that way every time? But those are facts that she knows of her personal knowledge, and she has the right to testify to them. With respect to Officer Ortiz, you're exactly right. It was a 403 decision. If you go back and read the court's decision, he says, based upon the fact that there are also reconstructionists on both sides who have done reconstruction work on this case. This officer didn't do a reconstruction. He did an investigation. He talked to the driver, but he didn't talk to Ms. Ireland. The driver lied to him, admittedly lied to him. He obtained some information about which marks were on the road. He misinterpreted some of those marks on the road. And here he is in a state trooper's uniform. He's going to come in and say, I think it was her fault. Well, we've got reconstruction. We've got reconstruction. We've got limited qualification because he's not qualified as a reconstructionist, only as an investigator. And yet he's going to come in a trooper's uniform and say, I think it was her fault. The court said, based on the basis of his opinion, the limit of his qualifications, and the potential that unfair prejudice or bias would outweigh the probative value of this evidence, I'm not going to let it in. That's such a discretionary ruling. This court was in position to look at that at that time and make that decision, and that's what the court did. The defendant did, in fact, have the opportunity to have the officer testify about those facts that he knew from his investigation. What did he see? Where did he go? Who did he talk to? But not his opinion as a result of those facts.
Did he testify?
I don't know if he actually testified.
Yes, he did.
He testified because the judge said he could testify to a limited certain thing.
He was permitted to testify.
Just not give an opinion.
I didn't know if he had, but I know he was permitted.
Okay, so he wasn't completely stricken.
Correct. He was only restricted from giving his personal opinion based on whatever information he had as to the fault related to the accident. I want to talk about the jury deliberation issue because I think it's. I think it's important to recognize what the standard is here. The case cited by the defense, the Hutchins case, says that it's improper for a court to threaten or coerce the jury for the purpose of compelling them to render a verdict. I don't think there's any question that that did not happen here. This court, and I don't think either Mr. Kane or anyone else would say that this court threatened or coerced the jury. The question here is whether, based on the fact that the court said, look, we, both the plaintiff and the defense and the court, want you to give this one more go. Both counsel and the court were in agreement that an Allen instruction was appropriate and that they wanted the jury to continue to deliberate. Nobody said, if they're hung, they're hung. We want to go home. We want to do this again another day. Everybody agreed the jury should be asked to continue to deliberate. And the terms of the Allen instruction were agreed. Everybody agreed, yep, that's the right instruction. That's what we need to tell them. The only issue here is, should the trial court have said, y'all go back to the jury room and pack up now, go home, sleep on it, give them the closing instructions, send them home, do not allow them to go back to the jury room and discuss this any further? Or could the judge do what the judge did, which is say, look, it's 4:30, we're going to want you to talk about this some more. y'all go back to the jury room. You decide if you want to talk about it a little bit more tonight, if you want to go home tonight, come back tomorrow. This is your call. We don't want you to feel like you're required to stay here until midnight. He didn't say it in those words, but the words are in the record. Y'all go back to the jury room and decide what you want to do. You want to stay tonight? You want to come back tomorrow? You want to talk about this some more now? We're going to want you to talk about it. You decide how you're going to do that. And so the jury went back to the jury room, and about 45 minutes later, they said, hey, we decided.
Didn't he say, let us know about 5 o'clock if you want to keep deliberating? Did they ever get back to him and say, yes, we want to keep deliberating?
I don't think anyone spoke to them at 5 o'clock. I think they didn't knock on the door, and I don't know that the bailiff knocked on the door. At least it's not in the record.
As I read the transcript, he gave them the option of saying, okay, we've had it, we want to go home. And apparently they decided not to go home.
Absolutely.
And it is kind of, if I may, the standard is hard. I mean, the law is, as you recite, Luster is a pretty strong case for you, as you say. But it occurred to me, too, what you said. You know, wouldn't it have been better, I recognize hindsight's 20/20, for the judge to say you're going home, as opposed to right before 5 to say, I'll give you the choice. You got to come back. You could either get this done tonight, keep deliberating, or come back tomorrow. There's something, I suppose, arguably inherently coercive about that, because nobody wants to come back tomorrow. I mean, it would be easier if the judges told them you're coming back tomorrow. Then they didn't have the choice. But if you're given the choice, you can either stay for a while, keep going, or come back tomorrow. I suppose this is an academic discussion, maybe. There is something that seems to me possibly inherently coercive about that, because you're basically telling them, you can get this done tonight or you're coming back tomorrow. And then, you know, wouldn't most reasonable people say, or many people say, I want to get this done tonight. I think that's what Mr. Kane's argument is on this point.
Perhaps. And I guess my question is, do we have so little faith in the jury system that we can, overnight, an hour in the morning, couple hours in the morning, really? We think this jury, and go back and read the Allen instruction, because it says nobody should surrender their consciously held belief. Don't be afraid to change your mind if, based on listening, you find that you may have misunderstood or that perhaps you were wrong. But you're not under any obligation to surrender your conscientiously held belief. And in terms of what constitutes threat or coercion, there is some additional guidance. Coercive deadlines. Well, you know, that's the judge is going to make you stay here for 2 weeks. You don't get this done, or you don't get this done now. I'm making you come back at 6 o'clock in the morning. Those are coercive deadlines. Threats of marathon deliberations, pressure to surrender your conscientiously held beliefs, or an implication of a false duty to decide. This judge didn't do any of those things. He said to 6 adult people, "Y'all decide. I'm not going to make this decision for you. Y'all talk about it." I think Luster is a very strong case. That's what happened in that case. And in that case, they were faster than this jury. And the Court of Appeals said, you know, give them just a little credit. They're grown-ups. Really, we can't rely on jurors whom we're giving the kind of authority that we give to jurors to say, look, if we can't decide this tonight, we can come back tomorrow. Really? Can we really not give them that much credit? And with respect to the excessive damage issue, I think the court needs to look back at the elements of the pain of the non-economic damage claim. It's not just, was she able to ride bikes again? And I believe that 5 months is incorrect. The accident happened in May of 2008. She was winning championships again in May of 2009, but she had a surgery in September of 2008, and then she had 5 months more of rehab in after September of 2008, and her physical therapist testified that Christine Ireland pushed herself to the point of tears, trying to get back to where she was as a result following this accident, that the therapist had seen very few, maybe no patients who put themselves through the level of pain that Christine Ireland suffered, trying to recover what she had lost after she was run off the road by a semi-driver who, frankly, I mean, can you even imagine having somebody in a truck that size drive by you and not even look in the rearview mirror until after you are in the wheels of the truck? Really? Would any? I would not, for $275,000, go through what Christine Ireland went through. And I think if it even crosses your mind that you would not, then this cannot be a judgment which is so outrageous as to strike everyone with the enormity and injustice of the damages. She was in a horrible situation. She was frightened within an inch of her life and, frankly, nearly killed. She was seriously injured. She went through a year of horrible pain. She went through a surgery, and she had to put her life back together because this driver didn't bother to look in his rearview mirror. Thank you.
Here we go.
He was allowed to blackboard $60,000 that he wouldn't have been allowed to blackboard 15 days before trial. The CPA's opinion changed from 78 to 75 just before trial, at the time of trial. Counsel suggests I should have cross-examined her on how she got these numbers. I had no idea. There was no report. Ortiz was an expert in accident investigation. He should have been allowed to testify. And I think the court's right. The extra issue is we want to get out of here. And that's something that shouldn't be an issue when they're making a decision like this. Thank you.
That was impressive, Mr. Page. I know Judge Furman will thank you both too, but yeah. I want to say I appreciate the courtesy and obvious professionalism on both sides in this case.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes the oral arguments for this docket.